I do think that art and literature are the opposite of irrelevant right now. You know, like
Right.
some people are like, oh, art, like when do we need art right now? What we need is science, and what we need is like to like really change corporations and change commerce. And absolutely, that's true. But one way to do that is art. One way to do that is to spread these messages wider and wider and wider through readers and viewers and people who see things differently now because an artist rendered it in a way that they could see.
Welcome to Sema. Camille Dungy joins me in this episode on loss as an ambient force, having children, cross-generational relationships, and the importance of storytelling in connecting individual loss with global crisis. Camille's teaching and ethic around community had a lot to do with the initial formation of Sema in 2018, and I'm so happy to share this conversation with her. Camille T. Dungy is the author of four collections of poetry, most recently Trophic Cascade from Wesleyan University Press, 2017, and a collection of personal essays, Guidebook to Relative Strangers from W.W. Norton, 2017. The poem Camille reads during the episode first appeared in the April 12th issue of The New Yorker. You can find a link to it, as well as the other texts we discuss, in the notes. As always, please take care when choosing to engage with any media, including this podcast. My name is CL Young. Thank you so much for being here.
I feel so often that my answer to this question is not, it's not particular, it's ambient. And so even when I can look to a particular grief, that particular grief is so often indicative of the air we breathe and just so much loss and catastrophe and near catastrophe and institutions built on suffering that we. And by we now, I actually maybe am being more particular, like in individual people and individual communities have to bear and still keep going. And so, you know, I can name. I can name people, but I think in the end, and this is also probably partially just a fact of the blessing of my life, that I'm not naming mother, father, child, husband, right? Like I feel like if I were naming mother, father, child, husband, this kind of ambient sense would particularize in a very different way than what I'm talking about. But at the same time, I feel like this whole year, I feel like I've been walking through, you know, I used to live in San Francisco, and there's times in San Francisco where you just kind of you're walking You can see the air. You can feel the air. Like you're walking through a cloud. You're walking through that fog that's so thick, that you can touch it and feel it on your skin and like see it settle down on your hand. Like you're like putting your hand into the steam around a witch's cauldron, right? And that's the way that I feel like this COVID-19 grief has settled on those of us who are willing to look at it. I mean, where are we now? 575,000
Something like that. Yeah.
dead? That is. That's an unfathomable number of mothers, fathers, husbands, children. That's an unfathomable number of individual griefs and losses. But they're not evenly distributed.
Yeah.
So some communities lose many, many people, and some lose none. And that disparity, is just yet more of the American experiential disparity that makes it really difficult for some people to believe that anything's wrong and impossible for other people to believe anything's right. So I went in a big swirly circle there. But that's, I mean, that's it for me, my loss. Like I mean, I can name in my own family, in my husband's family, I can name aunt, uncle, right? Like I can name real people. And I also understand that the reasons that we can do that have everything to do with some much, much larger issues that are not in any way new to this country. They just got exacerbated this year. I've been reading, first I read this book by Alison Cobb. It's a new book by Alison Cobb called Plastic and Autobiography. And it's so good. It's like just really gripping and informative, and plastic is just it's everywhere, it's in everything, it's shaped us, it's like made our culture what it is. We wouldn't have the atomic bomb if we didn't have plastic. We wouldn't have so much of our car culture. If we didn't have plastic, we wouldn't have a lot of medical equipment if we didn't have plastic, right? I mean, there's just so many ways in which plastic is just in the deep in the fabric of our culture. But there's so much decimation we also wouldn't have if we didn't have plastic. And so her book ends up actually going into some of these communities that are just decimated by plastic production, and also by nuclear testing and other things like that. So these communities again are the margins of our stories of what the loss and grief look like to live in our contemporary culture, right? Like we know about Midway Island and the albatross and the birds trying to feed their babies regurgitated plastic. We know that story, and that's a real story that we need to know, right? But I didn't know about the communities on the Gulf Coast that are being completely overrun by either the shipping that plastic requires or the production plants that are there. I didn't know about that. And I like to think that I'm pretty attuned to these kinds of questions, right? So if I,
Right.
who is really attuned to a lot of these questions and conversations, if this is news to me, right?
Yeah.
What does that mean? Like, what does that mean for like the national story of who we are and how we are and what we've lost? And so again, that like comes back to like that ambient. So all these displaced people, all of these people who now carry these toxins in their body, generation after generation, who bury so many of their relatives. It's like this cancer and that cancer and the next, so that it, yes, it's particular, it's an individual, but that's an individual who is at the epicenter of this global crisis, right?
Yeah.
And so that's part of my thinking about like storytelling, like how do we honor these individuals? How do we honor individual lives and individual loss and individual grief and not let the collective, corporate, large-scale replication of those individual losses over and over again off the hook?
Right.
It's storytelling, right? It's how we tell the realities of this world and say, yes, Aunt Mary, and also 15 other Aunt Marys in the same, because of the same kind of thing.
Bringing in Alison Cobb's book and ecological loss, how that interacts with humans and near-term human extinction. And when I think about the term eco grief, I always think of you. And I think my initial sort of conception of that phenomenon or that idea was sort of the through the loss of landscape or the loss of like places. And really, the real loss of that is loss of humans. And I mean, it's all of those things. I've been starting to think about this climate crisis, Armageddon, as a macro grief situation that humans have to deal with, because humans have such a hard time a lot of the time talking about death or loss or grief because it requires them to recall their mortality. And I think that this ecological loss that we're staring into is that on just the largest scale that we can conceive of, I think.
Yeah, I think part of it is that it has to, it makes us have to face our mortality. But another really important thing I think is it makes us have to feel our futility, like the ways in which it's not about recycling. Like
Right.
that's not what it really is about. Like, yes, of course, reduce, reuse, recycle. But that is putting kind of so like victim blaming in a way, right? Like what needs to get reduced is production, not the supply is going to keep getting flooded because of the ways that we have built this culture.
Right.
And so, as with so many of the things that need to be addressed in this country, if real change is going to happen, like substantial life-saving change, you really have to go back to the start and figure out how did we get so hungry for plastic. How did we get so hungry for police control on certain kinds of communities that look a certain kind of way? How did we get, you know, and every time we do that, it feels like change will be impossible. And so then we face our futility because it feels like, whoa, that those roots are deep, right?
Right.
The lobbies are there, and the money is there, and the power is there to keep things that way. And so then it's exhausting, and it feels like what you're grieving is the impossibility. The fact that it feels impossible to really make change
Right.
in the world, which I don't think is true. I actually do think it's possible to make change. I think it happens slowly, but I do think it's possible to happen. It's just like, whew, we don't have much time. Right?
Right.
Like, so how slow can we be when 2030 is 9 years away? But I think again, it's the story. It's like what stories we tell. It's the way that we make these stories relevant and expansive. And so thanks to Plastic and Autobiography, I was like brought like these communities that I'm talking about were brought to my attention, but also other artists who are doing this work and telling these stories are also brought to my attention. So, so then I learned things about a poet and activist named Kathy Jetnil Kijener, I think is how it would be pronounced. Jetnil Kijener. It's like Jetnil Kijener. And she's got a book named Yiyip Jaltek. She's from the Marshall Islands. She's Marshallese. And her poems are telling the stories of the diaspora that was forced out of the Marshall Islands because of nuclear testing, and the ways that those tests live in the bodies of the Marshallese, and right, like the kind of generations of illness and radioactive related cancers that befall the Marshallese, and also about the place, and also about climate change and the ways that that affects those low-lying atolls. And I may not have known about this book had I not come to that other story, which then opened me to other stories. And like this way of what is it? Like the way that we can pass the grief and share the message, and why it is that we like having communal memorial services, and not just going and mourning your person by yourself, but having your community around you. And the bigger the community, really, it's like a passing of the shouldering of the grief and of the story and of the fight. And so I do think that art and literature are the opposite of irrelevant right now. You know, like
Right.
some people are like, oh, art, like when do we need art right now? What we need is science, and what we need is like to like really change corporations and change commerce. And absolutely, that's true. But one way to do that is art. One way to do that is to spread these messages wider and wider and wider through readers and viewers and people who see things differently now because an artist rendered it in a way that they could see that they.
I feel like the last couple episodes have been thinking a lot about parent mothering themes, and I have this sense, and I don't know why, but that your daughter was so deeply wanted by you. And I don't know how to form this question. I don't want to put you in a direction too much.
She was deeply wanted by both of us. And I mean, I can't speak for my husband, but for me, it's because of him that I wanted a family. It just was never, it was never a part of my thinking about who I wanted to be. So, there's some people who've like always wanted to be a mother and like, nope.
Right. And I feel that way too. And so I think that's part of why I'm interested.
Was not. I never, I didn't, partially because this culture does not make it. They did. I don't care what we just had Mother's Day, but like, I mean, just like even that fact we have to like have a Mother's Day
Right.
to me, like, is like a statement or a testament to like actually how undervalued mothers are for the most of the rest of the year. It, we don't, we're one, we're, aren't we like the only developed nation that doesn't have. Mandatory parental leave. We like our maternal mortality rates are horrific. Our infant mortality rates are like not on par with those of other so-called developed nations in any way. Like it's really, we don't make it easy
Right.
to be parents and to be mothers in this culture. And like, and then when you add to that, I had this drive to be an artist and to make and to be a professor and to like make these parts of my lives that it was very clear when I was a young professor that the professors who had primary parenting roles, their career suffered for that. It's just very obvious that that was the fact. And that you could be a parent and a professor, but not the primary caregiving parent and the one with the on fire career. And so all that was happening around me. Now, I really actually think that some of these things are changing. That some of the things that as I was being, like growing up and early in my career frightened me so much. There have been so many active parents who are my peers and who've come before me who have changed these systems. And I and those who come after me benefit from the both active and passive work of many other people. But I'm just telling you like what was happening,
Sure.
in my late 20-year-old brain when I was like, I could do this and compromise those things that are so important to me or not. But then I met my husband and like he really is a partner. Like he really is a partner in so many ways. And some of the things that scared me about what that was going to look like weren't scary anymore because I knew that I wasn't going to be carrying all that just by myself. And so that changed the whole equation. Right? When I'm talking about doing that in true partnership, which may actually not even be equal 50-50, because it may be the a lot of times he's the one who's the 80% parent. You know what I mean? So like it's almost more often like if the disparity is gonna happen in our household, it's because of the things that he's taking on as opposed to me. And so that it just meant a whole other thing. And you know, I love him a lot. And so yeah, then there was that like, also, what would it be like to be pregnant? You know, like this is, it's like, what's this physical experience that is available to me? And so I tried it once. That was good. One time. And that I have that poem. It's Ray's favorite poem, Entropic Cascade, where it's a frequently asked question poem. I think it's number eight. Frequently asked question number eight. Are you gonna have another child? No. And that's the poem. So and again, this is so individual, these decisions, like whether or not you have a child, how many children you have, how, like, what kind of parent, like, do you give up your career or not? Like, all of these kinds of questions are so individual. There is no right or wrong answer. Every parent needs to make that decision for themselves. And what I want is a culture where you can make that decision for yourself. And the decision you make is like your decision because you have the support that you need, no matter what the decision is that you make. And that you're not like forced into a path because you don't really have any other options. And that's the only, but you know, so like your sense of like my daughter being a really wanted child, it again, like here we go back to this blessings. It's partially because I found this right partner. It's partially because when the economic pressures of living where we were living when we had her became really oppressive and impossible, we had this opportunity to move to a place where we could build the kind of life that we wanted, right? And so we didn't have to compromise those kind some of the things about what it would mean to be a parent because we couldn't afford to do the kinds of things that we wanted to do. So many people in this culture have to make not the decisions that they would make because of financial exigencies, because of religious constraints of their like religious society around them or just the ideas of the population, moral values, ethical values that are not the mother or the parents, but like these kind of things pressing, forcing their decisions. And I feel like, I mean, if we're going to talk about grief, I feel like so much generational grief and generational trauma that is visited and revisited and revisited on child after child after child has to do with not being able to make the decisions you know you need to make and being forced into some other kind of path because of things that are just beyond your control. And then that means anger, and that means giving up dreams, and doing things that you don't believe in because you have to. And you know, in my little dream world, that happens as infrequently as possible.
You're right that that is such a personal decision, and it shouldn't be made by these by sociological or cultural or economic factors. And I also have been thinking a lot about the environmental situation and having kids. And I mean, I think it's such a personal choice, and it's something that I wouldn't have judgment around people's decision around it either way. And yet, like, as I'm thinking about what it means to maybe have a child, it feels really more and more complicated in a way, like even in the past year. I mean, and I know that's a conversation in a lot of spheres, and people will always make their own decisions, but it's just hard, as I imagine, that to think about what the world will look like and bringing a person into that is it's a scary thing to think about. And I guess that's always true. It's always been true in one way or another, for particular communities more than others, but I think it's always been a scary world to bring a child into.
All of that is true. I mean, one of our reasons, there's a lot of reasons why we only have one child, but one of them is an environmental attention, you know, the numerical kind of questions of human population replacement population as opposed to exponential growth. But that cannot be like, I can't look at her and say, you don't have siblings because, you know, like that's not like that. That's like not, it's like one of 2,000 different reasons why we stopped at one, but it's there, you know, I'm like, it is one of them, that floats in my head. But, you know, one of the like, how do you bring a child into a world that's collapsing? As you say, the world has. For some of us, it's always been collapsing around us, and you raise that child. I mean, certainly in Black American culture, the answer for my people, at least for you know my family, has been you raise that child with knowledge and the tools and the experience, and the strength and the love that they need to survive the difficult world that you've brought them into, right? And that is not easy. And it means it demands a lot of a parent because you're not just like abandoning that child into terror. You're preparing them with knowledge that that is the world, you know? So I teach my child to grow things. I teach my child where food comes from. I teach my child about water scarcity. You know, like we talk about these things. I'm not pretending that they're not true. I'm not trying to return to my childhood and some like time where we didn't have to think about these things, right? So, which wasn't even true in my childhood that we didn't have to think about them. We just didn't, right? And so like, but that's not the world that I want for her. But the other thing, you know, I hear people say a lot, well, I mean, but I'm not going to be around in 2050. So, you know, and on they go with their behavior, or on they go not really trying to make a political impact that will change the like national trajectory. On they go like, as if it doesn't matter because they're not going to be here, but my child will be here. And my child's child, if she chooses to have one or adopt one, will be here. And so I'm invested. I care. I don't easily just say, I'm not going to be here in 2050 or 2080. So I do think that there is a way in which having children and grandchildren invests people who would not otherwise be invested differently in this story. That's like a counter argument to the how can
Sure.
I put somebody here in that, like, what you're doing is you're investing yourself in this struggle. You know, one of my favorite books is Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower. You've known me long enough, you probably know this about me. Like, I think I have like five different copies of that book because like every cover is like a thing or whatever. Like, she's just. But one of the things that's most interesting to me about that book is I read it when it first came out in the early 1990s. And when I read it, I aligned myself with Lauren Olema, Olamina, the main character in the book, who I would have been contemporary age-wise of. But a few years ago, I taught Parable of the Sower again, and I realized that my actual contemporary in the book is the man she partners with, who was born right around when I was born. And so, like, when I started reading the book, I align myself with the female character who was my age peer when I read the book. But now, when I read the book, I'm the age peer of this older generation person who's crucial to the book and who's planning and like several of the things that he did to prepare himself for this eventual catastrophe help save Lauren and their child, right? Like, his work is key, not to mention loving her, but that was also important, right? Like, so each generation has a role in this story. People don't ask this question so much for poetry, but for one of the questions for prose is always like, who is your audience? And I always have an answer that's kind of maddening to the marketing people because they want to have like one audience. But I'm like, but if I have that one audience, and like that like limits who this book can speak to, right? If Octavia Butler's only audience had been the 22-year-old me, I would not keep going back to that book. Because I would outgrow, you know, they have this joke line that I once read. It's like, the greatest disservice that you can redo to the book on the road is to reread it in your 40s or 50s. That book, you just have to read it in your 20s and you have to love it in your 20s. And then you just gotta like let
Let
it
it
stay
go.
there. But that's not what I want. I want my 80-year-old father to be able to read a book with as much interest as you, but different things, you know? What was one of the things that they say that I don't remember who told me this, and I've heard it more than once, so it may not have just come from one person, but like when you're in your teens and 20s and 30s, you should make a point of having friends who are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. And when you're in your 50s, 60s, and 70s, you should make a point of having friends who are in their 20s and 30s, you know? Because when you're younger and you have friends who are older and have seen other things and have other experiences, It helps give you the foundation you need and the perspective that you need. Like, it has been useful this year to have my parents around who lived through quarantines, right? Like, my parents are from the polio generation. Like, to have this conversation with somebody who had kind of experienced that, or, both of my parents are like, yeah, like, summer of X, Y, and Z, the movie theaters were closed and the pools were closed and we didn't get to go anywhere because polio, And like, so they are like, in a way, much more understanding about my daughter's grief, about what it is that she's lost, because they lost those things too. They experienced those kinds of, oh, we thought that we were going to have this, community theater thing, but sorry, everything's closed. Like, they experience that in their generation, and so they can listen differently than those of us who've never lived in a quarantine time can. And so that kind of cross-generational communication, I think, helps us be a more empathetic society and a more knowledgeable society. So that sense of every grief and triumph feels so individual, but really, so many other people have experienced those same griefs and triumphs individually themselves. And so, talking across generations to see how your pain is both unique and held by others, and how your joys are unique and held by others. I think, to me, that just centers me. It helps me feel a part of a world and not feel like you're spinning off alone.
Let me tell you, America, this one last thing. I will never be finished dreaming about you. I had a lover once, if you could call him that. I drove to his apartment in a faraway town like the lost bear who wandered to our cul-de-sac that summer. Smoke from the burning mountain altered our air. I don't know what became of her. I drove to so many apartments in the day. America, this is really the very last thing. He'd stocked up for our weekend together on food he knew I would like. Vegetarian pad thai, some black bean and sweet potato chili, coconut ice cream, a bag of caramel popcorn, loads of Malbec. He wanted to make me happy, but he drank until I would have been a fool not to be afraid. I've been drinking plenty too. It was too late to drive myself anywhere safe. I watched him finger a brick as if to throw it at my head. Maybe that's a metaphor. Maybe that's what happened. America, sometimes it's hard to tell the difference with you. All I could do was lock myself inside his small bedroom. I pushed a chest against the door and listened as he threw his body at the wood. Listened as he tore apart the pillow I'd sewn him. He'd been good to me, but this was like waiting for the walls to ignite. You've heard that, America? In a firestorm, most houses burn from the inside out. An ember caught in the eaves, wormed through the chinking, will flare up in the insulation, on the frame, until everything in the house succumbs to the blaze. In the morning, I found him on the couch, legs too long, arms spilling to the carpet, knuckles bruised in the same pattern as a hole in the drywall. Every wine bottle empty, each container of food opened, eaten, or destroyed. I didn't want you to have this, he whispered. If he could not consume my body, the food he'd given me to eat would have to do. Have you ever seen a person walk through the ruins of a burnt-out home? Please believe me, I am not making light of such suffering, America. Maybe the dream I still can't get over is that, so far, I have made it out alive.
Well, I think all the way in the beginning of our conversation, when you first asked the question, and I said it feels like ambient.
Yeah.
It's just ambient. It's just, it's like that foggy air in San Francisco that you just walk through to get on with your life. And so, because it's in the air, that kind of grief and trauma and rage, just all the time, I also need to find conversations with family and with friends, and I need to find art and make art and keep moving. I think I'm able to have hope because I really do see that I'm not alone in acknowledging that this is not okay. And so even though sometimes, some days, it feels impossible to me, or it feels futile to me, I know that on that day I can rest and somebody else is doing that work. And then I can come back. I know that if I don't rest and I don't find joy and I was going to say make love, and then I realized that has like those other connotations, but I'm actually going to stick with that, you know, because it's active. Creating a world when love exists is active. You have to make it. You have to do the acts, right? To create that. That I'm not going to have the strength that I need to be a truth teller. And I'm not going to have the energy that I need to do the work that to put my queer shoulder to the wheel, as Whitman said, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the balance for me. It's again, it's about some of these stories are horrific and ongoing and I get exhausted and I get angry sometimes, and then we have these like flare-ups where all of a sudden everybody's paying attention and they want to talk about it. And I'm like, I've been talking about this, you know, like why do you need to talk to me today? All of a sudden, just because you saw it. But you saw it. So there. Now keep seeing it, you know, keep looking. I talk sometimes about when I wrote my second book, just called Suck on the Marrow. It's a book of poems about 19th century America, like 1830s to 1850s, which was right when the domestic slave trade really exploded because the international access to Black people was shut down. And so all of a sudden people had to breed or kidnap or find this labor domestically. And it was a really gruesome time in American history. And So I decided to write a book of poems about it. And that book was very difficult to write. The research was difficult to conduct, the reading that I had to do, the primary documents I had to access, the stories I had to read were just horrific over and over and over again. That is true. I also remember that experience. I have to be very careful when I say this or how I say this, but I remember this, the experience of 4 years of writing that book with really great pleasure because of the places that that research took me, the people that that research connected me with, the some friendships that I've maintained all this time from the you know, the archivist who I connected with and the libraries I visited or the people I stayed with while I was going to these places. And then just the very act of building the poems and the craft elements and trying to the like architectural experiments that the poems demanded of me, like, just kept my little frontal cortex going and firing and delighted figuring out how to shape these poems. That is also part of the balance, right? When we make art, we're making and we're doing and we're taking these stories that on their surface are unbearable. And we're finding new ways to present them so they don't disappear. So they get read and they get seen and people's eyes open. That to me seems, oh, it feels like the luckiest job, you know?
Yeah.
It feels like I have been, that this charge that I have to be a truth teller, which is what I really believe that my job as a writer and a teacher demand of me, that something about that job has also given me these other things, these connections, these friendships, this joy in the craft, that makes it possible for me to keep going.
Thank you for listening to Sema. Initiated in 2018 as a reading and workshop series in Boise, Idaho, Sema aspires to nurture deep attention and connection as means for change. To join the mailing list or share your insights, please email sema.readingseries@gmail.com. The song in the background is by Teal Gardner. You can find a link to more of her music in the notes.